Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered, non-commercial, listener-sponsored, full-strength community radio on the air since 1968. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, anti-colonial, and LGBTQ+ perspective. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the hour. Our lineup today includes a variety of seemingly unrelated issues, contemporary and historical, but all of them investigate the various ways that we come together as friends, lovers, and comrades during difficult times to help and sustain each other and make the world a better place. Book Mole Larry Bolden reviews a novel that takes up the phenomenon of so-called surplus women after World War I wiped out a generation of British men. Sharon Grant speaks with Diana Rempe about Portland's bike-powered street library and how it brings people together in healing relationships. Closing our show, Bill Resnick interviews organizer Monica Pearson with the Rural Organizing Project of Oregon about their work to bridge the gaps between communities. Before we get going, I want to thank everyone who generously gave to KBOO during our fall pledge drive. If you missed the opportunity to give and would still like to, please go to kboo.fm and find the donate button in the upper right corner of the home page. Leading off this morning, we have Jan Hawkins speaking with psychoanalyst and activist Maureen Katz, who spent weeks at the Indigenous-led camps in resistance to Line 3 in the Midwest. They talk about the 5-year-long protest against the transport of toxic tar sands oil through Anishinaabe lands and the scope of state repression that their resistance has unleashed. They speak to the courage of frontline activists in sustaining the battle for climate justice and how hope is carved out of loss. Here's Jan and Maureen.
Welcome to KBOO, Maureen Katz.
Hi, it's so nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you spent weeks with water protectors at the Indigenous-led frontline camps fighting the construction of Enbridge's Line 3 in Minnesota. And as Enbridge prepared to start pumping tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada through Line 3 in Minnesota earlier this month, Winona LaDuc released a statement. So before we talk about your experiences there and how we might think about this defeat in stopping Line 3, I want to read a statement from LaDuc that was released the weekend before Indigenous Peoples Day. So here's the quote. "It's somehow fitting irony as Indigenous Day approaches on October 11th, once known by another name, that a new Columbus is about to pump oil through Line 3, the last tar sands pipeline. That is the colonial-like corporation Enbridge." Well, LaDuc, founder of Honor the Earth and a leader in the fight to stop Line 3, also listed in this statement the many victories of this 5-year struggle against the pipeline, as well as outlining some of what she sees as the future path of resistance. But let's start with that statement about the new Columbus. What does that statement mean to you, Maureen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful statement, and she has made many beautiful statements around, well, all along, but around the completion of the pipeline and the pumping of oil by Enbridge. But I don't know how new it is, the idea of large capitalist companies that don't care for the people at all, or the land, or the law in this case, and are sacrificing the future of everyone by pumping out tar sands and then putting oil through pristine areas and a fifth of the world's fresh waterways with multiple spills for the sake of profit. So that's one Columbus in discovering other people's property and lands and the rights of nature and just taking them over. I think the other Columbus that we should think about is that the state violence and the collusion of, in this case, the Minnesota State Police and Task Force, the Department of Homeland Security, and even this week with the climate strike led by Indigenous people in Washington, D.C., were the occupation of the Department of Interior by Indigenous people, peaceful, civil disobedience, nonviolent, no property destruction, was met with very harsh physical arrests by the police in D.C., by canine units, in a way that was so in contrast to how, for instance, the protesters who were violent and destroying property on January 6th were met.
Before we go into what the resistance faced in those Indigenous-led frontline camps in Minnesota along Line 3 construction sites, can you say a little bit about what led you to join the resistance there as a non-Indigenous person?
I went because there was a call that was put out in December of 2020 that said, we've exhausted all of the legal processes that we can, and we need people, the Indigenous communities, the Anishinaabe and the resistance within Minnesota said, we need people to come and become water protectors and come and support fighting this pipeline being built. So I wanted to answer that call and felt that that was just an essential way of doing the prevention of climate destruction, not just the mitigation of it after the fact, and also to support the treaty rights that were being violated flagrantly by Enbridge.
And that's one meaning of being an ally or a co-conspirator. There's different terms for joining a resistance that is in all of our interest, as well as fulfilling a moral obligation to address the history of violence and displacement of Native peoples.
Yes, absolutely. It's beautifully said. I think the question is, the issue is that it's not simply that we are redressing and trying to do our part to heal and not allow further damage to Indigenous peoples and violation of their lands and our treaties with them as white people or non-Indigenous. But I also think that there's a way that we are equally invested in the world that's going forward for our kids and our grandkids and our communities. So it's we all have a stake in this. In this case, it is this struggle has been Indigenous-led, as have been many of the major environmental campaigns to try to stop destruction of the earth. Right. So,
and this was also identified as women and Two-Spirit-led sites of resistance, and
yes,
in that sense was somewhat different from Standing Rock, and because the women in recent years and what's identified as Two-Spirit Native people have been at the forefront of the resistance and organizing and in leadership roles.
Absolutely. So what's quite remarkable is the way that this whole resistance was organized and went forward. Standing Rock, you had 11,000 people on the plains fighting, right, in Dakotas, fighting the crossing into the rivers or under the rivers for the Dakota pipeline. In this case, Enbridge decided they were going to avoid that and wanted to build all hundreds of miles all at the same time. It's also heavily forested. And there were 22 river crossings that they had to dig underneath. So there were a series of Indigenous-led camps that were bought and by Indigenous peoples and, as you said, Indigenous women and collectives that were two-spirited that set up a number of camps for people to come to that were resistance camps to do strategy and try to block what was happening with nonviolent civil disobedience. There was a task force that was called the Northern Minnesota Task Force. Then there was a center set up called the Fusion Center that was set up with the Northern Minnesota Task Force, paid for by Enbridge, along with the Homeland Security. And the Fusion Center surveilled all of these camps, and they won, for reasons of the Patriot Act, said that that in arrest cases, that the arrestees could not depose the records of the Fusion Center, so it was stayed secret how they were surveilling the different communities. And when I was at one of the camps, for instance, in February, there was constantly five cars outside of the Indigenous camp that was there, the protest camp, surveilling and harassing anyone who came in and out of the camp. So I was driving a rental car from the Minnesota airport, and they followed me every time I drove in from Park Rapids to the camp, and once tried to run me off the road, and pulled over numerous people. That was the early stages. Then they started blockading the camps, not letting people go into the camps that were legally owned by them and their own private property. And that escalated to the physical confrontations with protesters, where they were brutally arrested for misdemeanors, where they were, and that escalated to the agreement that they could use non-lethal force, which was rubber bullets and tear gas, as well as what they call pain compliance, which is taking people who have locked in to a structure so that they can block a road so construction cannot take place, and basically torturing. I'm a psychoanalyst, and I've worked with torture victims, and using methods that are CIA-instructed methods of torture to make people have so much pain that they will unlock themselves. So they did these pain compliance techniques. And all of this was happening nonstop for 10 months of the campaign to try to stop the construction of the pipeline.
So Maureen, before we stop today, I do want to talk with you as a psychoanalyst and an activist about how we recognize and mourn such losses that on one level, by one measure, this was a defeat, the fight lost. The Enbridge is pumping oil through that lethal pipeline. But there are many lessons that to be learned from this. Before closing, how could you say something both about the importance of mourning and grieving at these times, as well as looking ahead and rechanneling what we've learned and what Indigenous people have learned on the front lines of these struggles for a very long time, that leads them not to be surprised by how the state's enlisted in this way, but how we work with these two dynamics of resistance, both grief and loss, and the inspiration we gain and the insights in going ahead.
Yeah, definitely. And we need a whole nother show to talk about that. I think that there's been a movement and a consolidation of people working together under Indigenous leadership and also in their own communities about ways about how you stand up to this kind of bullying and illegal activity at the part of the state and corporations. And it's a phenomenal movement that involves older people. I was there with 1,000 grandmothers, younger people, you know, youth who are involved, a very diverse, two-spirited group of people that
is very intersectional in many dimensions and alliances across generations and across groups that may be anchored in different identities, but have this common sense of a threat to survival of the planet.
Absolutely.
On the planet itself.
That's right. And that is not a defeat. That is the strength of the movement. And what I had said to friends was, we lose until we win, because we have to win. And so, yes, this is a loss. It's not done yet. We will keep fighting this. But that is, in fact, what is necessary to happen. I want to say a quick thing about mourning. It's essential that people stop and take a moment and are able to mourn what it means to have had the land destroyed and this pipeline be built and this criminal activity take place. And mourning in this case does not mean having a grievance. It means being able to grieve, to be sad, to be able to internalize the movement and the sense of the power of what were the best of the things that were lost by this pipeline being built, and to be able to go forward then in a thoughtful way with strategy and tactics and gratitude towards the people that came together and led this and came to fight it, and then be able to go forward from that with that internalization of that, those positive ways that we've learned to work together in order to move forward. But if you don't grieve, then you don't actually acknowledge what's happened. and you can't move forward in a way that allows for healthy relationships and a sense of power, which is essential for the movement to be able to be successful.
And to be guided by the spirits that have gone before, even as whether secular or people from different spiritual traditions, that principle of being guided by those who've gone before and recognizing the losses, but also the wisdom and knowledge that comes out of knowing our histories.
Absolutely. And it means tolerating sadness, right? And not just having that turn into anger or self-destructive or community-destructive behaviors. Because that's allowing the oppressor to take occupation inside of us.
As groups fight against each other, as the enemy recedes from reach, there can be this dynamic of turning on one another.
That's right. Who didn't do enough? Who didn't do the right thing?
Maureen Katz, thank you so much for being with us today and talking about the Stop Line 3 fight. And I hope to have you back on the show and to talk further about these dynamics you only briefly were able to touch upon at the end. Thank you for your work as a water protector, an earth protector, and we'll talk again.
Great. Thank you, Jan.
That clip of music is the classic by Bob Marley, Get Up, Stand Up. Before that, you heard Jan Hocken and Maureen Katz speaking of Indigenous-led resistance against Line 3. What happens when a generation of young men is wiped out, leaving the surviving women to build lives in the absence of husbands and children? To their community, they are surplus, unneeded, and perhaps even unwanted. That doesn't mean they cannot find occupation, worth, and joy in their own company. Bookmole Larry Bolden reviews the 2019 novel, A Single Thread, by Tracy Chevalier, which explores the ways women once came together in the absence of men. As usual, I will be reading Larry's review for him. It is 1932. England and all of Europe is still under the cloud of World War I. So many men died in the war that there are thousands upon thousands of young widows or unmarried so-called spinsters who are dubbed surplus women, women who will be unlikely to marry or have children. Violet Speedwell is one such woman. At 38, she has lost both her older brother and her fiancé, Lawrence. Violet's mother is inconsolable over the death of her oldest son and is super critical of her daughter, so much so that she makes Violet's life miserable, and Violet longs to get away from her home and town, where she feels suffocated by the life of caring for her aging mother. When Violet spots an ad for a typist in a nearby town, she applies and immediately accepts the low-paying job when it is offered. Quote, "When it became clear that Mrs. Speedwell was not going to see her off as she normally did, watching from the doorway until visitors were out of sight, Violet went over and kissed her on the forehead. 'Goodbye, Mother,' she murmured. 'I'll see you next Sunday.' Mrs. Speedwell sniffed. 'Don't bother. I may be dead by then.'" End quote. And thus Violet begins her new life, living in a boarding house with other young women and working long hours typing forms for an insurance company. Excited by the new freedom, she puts up with meals of sardines or beans on toast. Quote, "She took herself to the cinema every week, her one indulgence, which she paid for by going without a meal that day." End quote. Her life is dreary and lonely until one day she goes to the Grand Cathedral in Winchester and happens on to a particular service, one filled with mostly older women. She is not at the church to pray. Quote, "Prayers had died in the war alongside George and Lawrence and a nation full of young men, end quote. It turns out to be a special mass for broiderers, i.e. women who embroider seat cushions and kneelers for the hard wooden benches of the cathedral. At first, blocked from entering the group, she persists and eventually is allowed in, and so begins a new and much less socially impoverished life as she befriends other broiderers and comes under the very kind tutelage of Miss Pessel, one of two women in charge of the group of women. When I picked up this novel, I knew nothing of spinning, weaving, crocheting, or embroidering, but I was fascinated by the descriptions and by the friendships between the women. Although Violet has had very limited introduction to needlework, she quickly takes to it under the watchful eye of Miss Pessel. She also becomes friends with an older man, Arthur, who is a bell ringer for the cathedral. Arthur is married to a woman who is frail and ailing, unable to recover from the loss of her son in the war. In order to be allowed to attend the daytime broiderers' meetings, Violet comes up with a plan to improve efficiency in the insurance office, such that it will allow both her and Olive, the other typist, to attend the meetings. Quote, "But, Miss Speedwell, I shall say this idea came from me, if you don't mind," he added with a frown. "I can't think what management would say about a girl having such a progressive idea." End quote. The author, Chevalier, has such a wonderful ear for the nuances and prejudices of this time in a Europe decimated by one war and on the eve of another. Violet decides on a walking tour in the country in place of the holidays of the past spent with her mother and younger brother and his family. She has a frightening encounter with a man she calls the Corn Man, having met him in a cornfield and then followed by him. Having walked to the small town where Arthur lives, she confides in him about the scare she has had. Quote, "He frightened you?" "Yes." Arthur looked at her, waiting. "It's not easy being a woman on your own," Violet explained after a moment. "No one expects it, though there are plenty of us, the surplus women. One would think it would not be such a surprise to see a woman walk through a field or have a cup of tea in a pub." End quote. Among the broiderers, Violet becomes a special friend of Gilda's. And Gilda seems to light up when yet another woman, DJ, Dorothy, shows up at meetings. Quote, "When Gilda appeared, out of breath and shouting hello, DJ started and suddenly solidified as if outlined by solid black. She did not stop smiling, but her eyes drifted toward the corner of the room as if to dodge attention. Gilda, too, seemed out of sorts, looking everywhere but at DJ and laughing a little too brightly as she removed her cloche. Violet discovered that there was something to discover, though she did not yet understand what it was." End quote. Only Violet and eventually Miss Pessel accept the relationship between the two women. Quote, "There was something around them that made them seem closer than others, although they were not actually standing closer or even looking at each other. It was like an invisible fence penning them together." That's what can happen when you're a spinster. It was said quietly, behind Violet, one woman to another. There was sarcasm in the words and a harshness and something like fear. End quote. Violet comes to see just how lovely and natural the relationship between Gilda and DJ is, opening her eyes to new possibilities. This is such a lovely little novel, I didn't expect to be so intrigued by it, reading it as a kind of respite from two rather heavy novels. But by the end, I knew I had to call it to the attention of other readers. I have been talking about a stunning novel by Tracy Chevalier, A Single Thread. This is Patricia Kullberg reading for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And you are tuned to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored radio. Portland is lucky to have Street Books, a mobile bicycle-powered library with the mission to empower people on the streets through access to literature and create a community of support for people living outside through a shared love of books. Today, we have Sharon Grant in conversation with longtime Street Books volunteer Diana Rempe about crafting community on the street.
Welcome, Diana Rempe, to KBOO.
Hello there, Sharon Grant.
Thanks for being here. So I just want to start off by saying, whenever I mention street books, the majority of people say, you mean street roots, right?
Yeah.
So what is it and how does it work?
All right. So Street Books, we are a mobile bicycle powered lending library for folks living outside and at the margins here in Portland. And I want to say to the street roots thing, that happens to us all the time. We take it as a wonderful compliment because Israel Bayer actually helped us out years ago get the project started. And we love street roots and we still collaborate with them all the time and think they're the best. So we're glad if we're going to get confused with anybody, we feel pretty honored that it's street roots.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So how long has Street Books been around?
Yeah. So we've been around for about 11 years and it started out as a 3-month art project. Laura Moulton had this idea that she'd go out and do what's called a social practice, art project, where she would interact with people on the street and just do that for about 3 months. So she created this bicycle. She and her brother built up the library. It folds out to become a library. We still use that bike. And she went out to the South Park box and just showed up there and started offering books to people. And almost immediately, people really started coming back and they'd check out a book and be gone for a week and come back and get another one. And so at the end of 3 months, Laura planned what was supposed to be her last shift. She got there and there was this fellow with his book and she realized, oh, I'm going to keep doing this. And so we joined her and started spreading out across the city in different places. I went over to the east side and started a shift over at St. Francis Dining Hall and over at VOS, the Day Laborers Center, bringing books to people who were primarily Spanish speakers. Another woman helped out and was at a different place. A guy was over at Sisters of the Road. We were at Right to Dream 2. And suddenly we found ourselves 11 years in and all over the city.
And so in that period of time, I mean, that really is a long time to be doing something like that, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not some huge organization with big funding and all that. So what impact do you see Street Books having on the community that it serves?
Well, that's a great question. And it's really the reason that we have kept on doing this, because we see that it has a really deep impact, both on the folks that we're working with and also on sort of everyone out in Portland. And I know that's a big statement, but what I mean is that Street Books at its heart reminds housed people that people living out on the street are full human beings who have the desire for connection, a life of the mind, a relationship with other people, just like people living inside do. As you know, there's a tendency for people that are housed, not all people, of course, but many people, to view unhoused people as somehow subhuman, as not connected to them, as somehow as other, we would say. And I think that Street Books has this remarkable, simple ability to remind people otherwise. You know, when someone is out reading a book or talking to someone about books, it's just this really simple reminder. Like, here's an example. We used to go to the waterfront and do a shift there. And invariably, there would be lots of people who would be jogging by, maybe with headphones on, and they'd run by and they'd sort of catch a glimpse of the bike out of the corner of their eye. And they'd be like, oh, that's weird. And they'd run over to it to check it out. And then they'd like be looking at the books and all of a sudden they'd be reaching for a book. And at the same time, somebody with a backpack on, one of our library patrons, would reach for the same book. And we'd mm-hmm. witness this connection when they looked at each other, where the person who'd been jogging mm-hmm. by would see the other person as the same as them. You know, like they had this thing in common. And it sounds really simple, but I think it's really profound. So in that way, I think Street Books just operates as this continuous reminder of the humanity of people making their way outside. And also, I think Street Books is really important to the people that we serve because we show up every week at the same time in the same place. And we know that people by name, when we're asked to get something, a book, you know, like maybe I want the third book in a series, they might say, and we show up with it, we're coming through with something that's promised. And I know that sounds simple, but it's, I think a lot of people living out on the street are often let down. They're let down by the broader system. They're let down by individuals within the system. And there's something really tangible and meaningful about having somebody follow through, recognize you by name, say hello, and do what they said they were going to do.
And, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know that I worked in county clinics for a long time, and
yes,
people get disappointed all the time.
Yeah.
Having expectations for things that they absolutely need for their living.
Yes. Just like basic human needs.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I think one of the things we often ask people to do who call us up or who reach out to us and say, how can I help? Is we say, you know, of course you can give us books, you can give us money, you can, you know, help us out there. But really, you can just come along on a library shift and see what it's like. And people come along and they get their minds blown because it's just this kindness and connection happening moment after moment out on the streets, because the streets feel like a scary place, especially right now. And I think that Street Books acts as this kind of conduit for letting people actually fully see one another out on the street instead of just being this kind of like imagined frightening kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's really important now because people are complaining about the streets of Portland being a mess and, you know, all these people out there on the street, you know, they can't get their garbage picked up, you know, trying to find food.
It's hard. It's since COVID, especially, it is really hard. But bottom line is people need a place to live. And if they can't pay the rent, if they can't afford a place to live, they have to live somewhere. And until we as a society figure out how to make sure that everybody can afford the rent, we're going to just see this happening.
Yes.
You know, it's really quite simple and we make it very, very complicated, but people need a place to live in. And until they can afford it, they're going to live on the streets. And that's a bummer. You know,
what impact does this work have on you?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. You know, I have been blown away since the very beginning of doing this. And I started working with Street Books. I think this is 9 years for me. It's 11 years for the project, 9 years that I've been doing my own library shift.
Wow.
Yeah. And every time that I go out and I work out on the street about 3 days a week, and every time I'm struck by how generous people living on the street are to welcome me, who's just offering a paperback and a set of reading glasses, and now with COVID, a mask, to welcome me into their lives week by week is such a gift to me. I mean, people are so generous and their hearts are so big. And I love that. It restores my faith in the world, which I need so selfishly. It's really great for me. I was trained as a community psychologist. So someone who pays attention to the way people are affected by the place they live, but that they also affect the place that they live. So we are affected by our context as our context affects us. And Street Books has been this wonderful and really amazing place to see that in action. So again, selfishly, I get to do the work that I thought that I would do, but in a lived setting. And that's really meaningful. But mostly it just reminds me of how good people are.
We have just a couple seconds left, and I just want to ask you, how can people support Street Books?
Well, you can reach out to me at Diana, D-I-A-N-A, at streetbooks.org, and I will tell you. Or you can click on our website, which is www.streetbooks.org, or on our Instagram, which is street.books. So there's some ways to connect with us. Also, we've just released a book that Laura Moulton, who started the Street Books Project, and one of our long-term 11-year patrons, Ben Hodgson, wrote together. And it's called Loners, LOANERS, Loaners, The Making of a Street Library. And it's a wonderful book. So pick it up, read it, and learn more about our project.
Awesome. We have to end there. I really appreciate the time, Diana. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sharon. You're the best. Thanks so much.
This is Sharon Grant for KBOO.
That was a clip from another classic I'm sure our listeners recognize, Bridge Over Troubled Waters by Simon and Garfunkel. Before that, Sharon Grant spoke with Diana Rempe about street books. Be sure to check out Loaners, the book just out, co-authored by Street Books founder Laura Moulton and one of her very first patrons, Ben Hodgson. The Rural Organizing Project has been at work since 1992, seeking to build just communities through challenging right-wing and anti-democratic currents in rural Oregon. Closing our show today, Bill Resnick interviews Monica Pearson, an organizer with ROP, about their roadmap to a thriving rural Oregon, yet another example of folks coming together to improve conditions in their own lives. Here's Bill.
Hi, Monica Pearson. Welcome to KBOO here in Portland.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Monica Pearson is on staff as an organizer for Oregon's Rural Organizing Project. She lives in Astoria. She's responsible for organizing along the whole coast and the, in fact, southern border all the way east on top California. The Rural Organizing Project has 82 member organizations, probably a few more recently, none in Multnomah County, but lots of organizations fighting for the interest of mostly low-income people across the rest of the state, attempting to build power behind progressive struggles. Today, we'll be discussing how the Rural Organizing Project, how it works with those 82 organizations, and we'll also discuss what rural people, how it is to organize them, what they believe and why. Why so many resist, for example, vaccination, and many regard masking as a badge of slavery, but surely not all, and surely Bundys have very few followers, actually, and many, many have nothing to do with that radical, relatively violent conservatism, but also they're deeply suspicious of government and blame environmentalists for loss of jobs in mills and the woods. Still, they can be talked to and won over. Monica Pearson, tell us about the Rural Organizing Project and how you operate.
We work closest with just individual member groups. So all of our groups in the network are autonomous. And there are moments that our groups will come together, like behind a certain movement. We had a big win last year. We were part of a coalition of member groups and other organizations that came together to like overturn the ICE contract at NorCor. So that was a big win for us last year. When you're talking about working with tribal governments, what we really try to do is just amplify the things that the tribes are already saying. Over the summer, there were some things happening in Klamath Falls. Eamon Bundy's group set up a tent in Klamath Falls, like right near a water shutoff valve. The ranchers and the tribe there were having discussions. It's been an ongoing thing, but just about who has rights to the water there. And Eamon Bundy's group set up a tent right near the water shutoff valve. So people were poised thinking like they were going to turn on the water to go to the ranchers. But what Rural Organizing Project does is we just want to amplify what the tribe itself is already saying. We don't want to speak for the tribes. We just amplified what they were saying. And that's what our groups that we work with have done as well. Like I visited Klamath Falls over the summer and met with some of our member groups, and they were all just following what the tribe was saying. They were trying to not give attention to you know, these outsiders essentially that were coming in and saying that they knew what was best for the folks in Klamath Falls. Like the folks in Klamath Falls, they're the ones that know what's best for them. And we've done the same thing with other tribal governments. There's the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla. Their leadership council has been working on trying to remove dams along the Snake River. So we've tried to amplify that. And then there's other Klamath tribal organizers that are working with trying to stop, you know, considering dams to be clean energy projects. So those are things that, I mean, we're not part of the decision making. We weren't the ones coming up with the plans. We just were supporting those tribal organizers in their efforts and trying to just amplify what they were saying.
Right. I think, though, you're being a little too modest. If I've read your materials, because you've gathered these groups together to build a program for the development of rural areas, and particularly the concerns of very low-income people in rural areas who are very poorly served, not just by the state. In fact, the state probably serves them better than the corporate apparatus in this country, who not only move out their groceries from poor areas in cities, but they don't, in fact, they don't want to serve. There's just too little people there and too little money. So you don't get broadband. You don't get all sorts of stuff that's very important from the private sector. Tell us about how you're unifying all of these separate voices and separate people.
So the biggest strength with Rural Organizing Project really are the relationships that we have with our member groups all around the state. We've been around for 30 years, so these relationships are not new. We have some folks that we organize with now that we organized with their parents, and they remember being a kid at a rally, for example. But through conversations and strategy sessions and town hall meetings, or we call them kitchen table conversations, just make them more personal, or living room conversations, we gathered, you know, what's important to folks all around Oregon? What are they missing living in a rural area? And we came up with our roadmap to a thriving rural Oregon. And it's broken down into like four categories. The overarching categories are, you know, we're all essential. And what that encompasses is like free childcare for all, safe housing, safe schools, safe workplaces, healthy and accessible learning environments. Another category is healthy people make healthy communities. So, you know, right now at this time, it's COVID testing and tracing treatment sites and making sure that's accessible in rural communities. Healthcare for everyone, sustainable local food production, healthy food, clean water. Another category is safe and welcoming communities. And that includes affordable housing and utilities, inclusive democracy, rent or mortgage forgiveness, like during COVID. That also includes the ending of detention and deportation and providing permanent protection and dignity for immigrants and safety from state violence. And then our last category is connecting our voices, which includes publicly funded community media. You mentioned broadband. Broadband internet is huge. It's a huge miss in rural communities, but it really is not accessible. Celebrating rural Oregon's mosaic of experiences, and then fully funding the United States Post Office. Then our roadmap, what we use this for is we have more conversations. Like if there's a new group that we're organizing with, we'll sit down and kind of show the roadmap and like what is missing in your community. Because this is just a broad stroke for the whole state. You know, there are communities that have figured out some broadband local resources or mesh systems. We've seen that popping up in different communities. Like right now, Tillamook County, the county commissioners there are trying to work on broadband there. So we've seen that popping up in certain communities. But like, what's missing in your community? And then from there, we help the groups figure out, what's your plan of action? What are things you want to be fighting for? What's really needed in your community? So, and that's where we try to bring other groups together. Like when we're working countywide, if there's a larger thing that we need more voices, you know, we will try to mobilize our groups. And we've done that in moments for the whole state as well. But that's how we bring people together, really, is around our roadmap and helping groups understand that the power that they do have, there really is power in speaking up. And in rural communities, you know everybody. You either grew up in the area, or even if you moved in fairly recently, you quickly network with folks. And it's amazing, like, when you realize your own power and people that you know in certain places that might know somebody's brother or somebody's cousin. So, like, we don't take any of that for granted. And we help groups and individuals understand the power and the connections that they have in their community and how they can advance their community and themselves.
Yeah, you also, as far as I can tell, are working to not just help people communicate through broadband. Of course, broadband gives you the internet and much more access to what's happening in the world and the organizations. But you also are trying to set, I mean, working with people who are trying to set up little newspapers. I think you have a statewide radio show or podcasts, at least. It seems to me that what you're doing is helping to create this the recognition in rural Oregon that they have common problems and that they can be solved, and the nature of the problems and the nature of solutions.
You actually mentioned earlier about, you know, why people are anti-mask and anti-vax and like that. And what Rural Organizing Project tries to do is help break isolation. Like, I mean, I'm not an expert on why people are anti-mask or anti-vax, but when you talk to people in rural communities, they really do feel isolated. They feel like they were left behind and they're kind of in a void of news. There's probably not a radio station local, like, or if there is, you know, it might just be playing oldies or something. It's not necessarily a news outlet. The news they get is piped in from Portland, like that's their local news, even though that's not local to them. I mean, I have some groups down in Coos County and farther down the coast that, like, their news is coming from California. Like, they don't have any news outlets at all. So ROP has worked really hard trying to help break that isolation. And through trying to, like, we do have a podcast that is broadcast on a lot of community radio stations. You can also listen to it online. It's called Rural Roots Rising. And then we also spend a lot of time as organizers when we go into communities. If there is a local paper, we talk to the folks there at the local paper and try to strategize. Like, a lot of our groups might have a column and it could be a little arts paper, but it's something. It's something like community-based that is getting information out to folks. Like, we've noticed it is a void of news that people are getting, you know, and unfortunately then when there aren't other sources, people turn to Fox News or what other random other podcasts that they might find online. So we do try to focus as much on that. And that's why broadband has bubbled up really as such an important issue, is because it does impede people's ability to get news. And we also focus on post offices. Why do you worry about post offices? But that's people's livelihood as well. Like, farmers, they get seeds that way. People get their medication, and some people don't have vehicles to drive 40 miles to the next post office. And a lot of times post offices end up being similar to what libraries are. They're kind of the lifeblood of the community. It's a place that neighbors go and they'll see their friends or they'll see other folks that they haven't seen in a while. So really, like, the breaking isolation has always been a focus for Rural Organizing Project.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, talking to Monica Pearson of the Rural Organizing Project, who have made progress in all these years. We've been talking about their effort to help projects, to amplify their voices, as well as to help people in rural Oregon, the progressive movements. Oregon is full of them, and the Rural Organizing Project has 82 members, and that's been growing recently. They've made progress in all these years, but it seems to me that, for example, now it's a rare rural area where over 50% of the residents are vaccinated. Many are hostile to masks. So rise in Maine populism is real, and Trump has really jump-started Trumpism has had an enormous effect on bringing people together around a hideous program, and his hostility to liberal elites and to progressives, and in fact to all elites, and his fake populism, it's very appealing, I'm afraid. What's your sense of how Trumpism, about how that right-wing thrust can be blunted, and how a progressive movement can perhaps arise in rural areas, at least contend in rural areas?
I mean, really, the way that we talk about changing things or combating it, or I don't know what the right word is, but it's really just having conversations and putting faces and real stories to rural folks and what is happening. Like, for example, we try to highlight immigrant stories. You know, you mentioned like sheriffs collaborating with ICE, and we've seen that in several counties. It was happening in the county I live in Clatsop County, until we got a new sheriff. But we talk to groups, and groups will sit down with the sheriffs and ask them questions. It's about having conversations with your neighbors. And if you talk about like immigrants that live in the community and struggles that they have and put a human face to it, it does help break down some of the barriers. I mean, obviously there are people that are, you know, really extremist that's not going to work with. But in general, that is really the best way that we have found, is to just make it as human as possible.
By talking about real stories, it seems to me, and real people, it puts a whole different face on this right-wing rhetoric about, oh, blacks, and about immigrants taking their jobs and getting better health care than they have, and their fears of the city and of black people bankrupting the federal government by demands for welfare and welfare queens. That whole rhetoric has been fairly useful for the right. And clearly one way of dealing with it is through these conversations of what's happening to real people and the real need to give up this fear of other poor people and recognize that their interests are similar. You know, one of the things in rural areas that's at the root of much of the right-wing organizing and the moving into this rabid racist conservatism is the great economic decline of rural areas, the disinvestment, that feeling of being left alone in a very complex world. And particularly in Oregon, it seems to me, there's the question of what happened to our lumber industry and milling and jobs and even small farming, which is so many people have been driven off the land. They just really can't compete and sell their products and can't even get credit for the next crop cycle. How do you deal with that, especially the logging issue and the anger at environmentalism?
It is really trying to have conversations. Logging industry now is not anything like logging industry used to be years ago. You know, it's not the same manpower that goes into it. It's not as many jobs, but unfortunately, some of these logging companies are running all of this out of fear. And it is people's livelihood. You know, if you're a fisherman or you're a logger, or and you know yourself that your income has declined. So it is losing their way of living, and that is scary. And I don't know that there's a way to make them change their minds, because it is affecting them directly. But overall, like, if folks are on board with, you know, jumping on that whole like timber unity, or like, you know, that we need to bring logging back, a lot of those, they're not coming back. With global warming, things are changing, and there's different industries that can thrive. And it's just having conversations with members of the community that, you know, like, it doesn't have to get heated. I know that the media shows it, that we're so divided and nobody talks to each other, but that's really not how it is living in a rural area. We all depend on each other. We go to city council meetings. I mean, even where I live, my neighbor across the street, I know he voted for Trump, but we're still out in the driveway talking to each other, and the dogs are playing, and we have to figure out ways to still coexist, because we depend on each other in rural communities. But it's through those just normal conversations, taking any opportunity you can, you know, like, I don't let things slide. You know, with my neighbor, if he's talking some nonsense about that January 6th didn't happen, I will say something, you know, not necessarily accusing, but just asking questions like, how did you find that information? Where did you hear that? And then maybe citing things like, oh, well, maybe you should look at this. And it's just in these normal conversations, you know, redirecting or helping educate wherever we can. People that are really extreme, I don't know that you can actually change their minds. And that's why we work with groups to make sure that they are voicing their concerns. For example, if your city council has a declaration that you don't agree with, or somebody says something racist, somebody in the group needs to say something. And we've seen that happening all over the state. We had it in Newburgh. It's been in the news lately about the school board there banned Black Lives Matter and Pride flags. So there are tons of community members there that are standing up and, you know, saying this is not a reflection of what we want in our community. So, you know, it might seem like the loudest voices are these extreme voices, but I don't believe they're the majority. Some people just might be fearful to speak up, but Rural Organizing Project, we just encourage our member groups and show them different avenues they have and ways to speak up and make sure that their voices are heard. And part of it is visibility that other people in the community know, like, hey, there are other folks here that are not anti-vax and not anti-mask. You know, it's important to make sure that that visibility is there and that we're showing that, you know, that is not what all rural folks are about.
And let me add one reason that people can feel free to speak up is that they know there's a group in Oregon called the Rural Organizing Project that has their back. That is, they will support them if times get really bad and they're under attack. This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, talking to Monica Pearson of the Rural Organizing Project, helping to fortify the various groups and unify them. You're doing great work, Monica Pearson. Why don't you tell us how people can contribute and learn about you and contribute to your work?
The best way is to go to our website, which is www.rop.org. You can donate right from the homepage there. You can learn about our organization. There's a tab about our work, and you can see what member groups we have throughout the state, who is part of our network of human dignity groups around Oregon. You can also learn about our archive collection. We're in our 30th anniversary, and if you want to volunteer with us or donate money, you can do all of that and connect with us from our website on www.rop.org.
Monica Pearson, thanks for talking to us today. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap for today. I want to thank Moles, Jan Hocken, Larry Bolden, Sharon Grant, and Bill Resnick for their contributions, John Nelson and Denise Morris for their editing assistance, and our guests today, Maureen Katz, Diana Rempe, and Monica Pearson. A shout out as well to the staff at KABU, busily keeping the station afloat so you, our listeners, can continue to enjoy non-commercial community radio in Portland. Our fall pledge drive is over. Our need for your support is not. If you can, please donate today to your community radio, KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host for the past hour. Catch us again next Monday at 9 a.m. I'm going to go out today with another solidarity classic, El Pueblo Unido, or The People United by Inti Illimani. Thanks for listening.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. De pie.